You can listen to The Professional Left on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or at our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, where you can also contribute to this podcast. There is a PayPal button at our website, or you can mail us a letter and or contribution at P.O. Box 9133, Springfield, Illinois, 62791.
This is the podcast for July 15th, 2016. It's not safe for work. Recorded live from the planning committee of the Rio Olympics, who asked the RNC, "Hey guys, do you need any help?"
It's the Professional Left with Drift Glass and Blue Gal.
Hey Drift Glass.
Hey Blue Gal.
Hey, this is an abbreviated podcast this week. We are going to be live at Netroots Radio this weekend.
We will.
Please listen in to us at netrootsradio.com Saturday afternoon, and also follow us at Pro Left Podcast, all one word, on Twitter. I will be tweeting when we're on and where we are, etc., over the course of Netroots Nation. If you are there, you will know where we are. If you are listening or wanting to listen and hear us live Saturday afternoon, we will alert you to that at Pro Left Podcast. So we're excited. We take off tomorrow morning.
And I don't know. I'll probably be tweeting under my own Mr. Electrico.
Oh, sure. Me too. Yeah.
To let you know how much what I'm really thinking. You
know? Okay.
Yeah. They'll start spinning out around 1 in the morning.
They're gonna kick you out.
Yeah. I got kicked out of liberalism. Goes right on the resume.
All right. So, Drift Glass, we have a couple things we want to talk about this week. Couple of topics on our notes. One thing, just to let everybody know, we did not attend Hillary Clinton's speech yesterday.
No.
In Springfield, because we didn't have tickets. So it was a ticketed event. Yeah. So next time someone's in Springfield, I understand we might be able to get press passes, but we'll see. I'm not going to get too excited about that. We'll see if that happens. But one of the things I wanted to talk about just as a review of the week is about how to be on script versus how to be off script, and how that affects coverage of things, our coverage of things, and also how the media fails at coverage of things.
Miserably.
On Tuesday. Yes, it was Tuesday. On Tuesday this week, we got up early. Over at Crooks and Liars, because there was a lot going on that day. First of all, the first thing that happened in the morning was John Conyer gave a statement to the committee that was interviewing Loretta Lynch, Attorney General Loretta Lynch, in their continuing witch hunt over the Hillary Clinton emails. And he gave quite a remarkable speech about what Congress should be doing versus what Congress is doing. And that Congress had 3 more days. They're now, as of today, done for 7 weeks. And, the Zika funding, just a whole host of things that needed to be addressed by this Congress were not addressed by this Congress. But we have time for emergency interviews with the FBI director and the attorney general, because we didn't get the result we liked on Hillary emails. And so John Conyers gave an address just about this in general. And so because of that, by the way, breaking news, it's Pence. Have you heard that?
No.
As of this moment, it's 12:08 p.m. on Thursday. Uh-huh. Speaking of sources, my editor just said, it's speculation. Oh, wait, Breitbart says it's true.
Yeah, well, there you go. And if you can't believe Breitbart, really.
Your source for accurate Stop Trump information.
Yeah.
And okay, there's breaking news that you will hear well after the fact, but it just broke for us. All right. John Conyers speech. So that was there, and it was something that Crooks and Liars wanted to cover. And I'm really taking you behind the scenes at Crooks and Liars right now. So we always post video of these things at Crooks and Liars. That's why people come to Crooks and Liars. And then we post transcript of whatever we're doing. And we wait to put up the post in general until the person that has given the speech, their office or their whatever organization has released the prepared statement or a transcript of what they've said. There is a difference between a prepared statement that's released and a transcript that's released. The transcript is what they actually said. A prepared statement is they have a speech on their teleprompter or in their hands, and they can go off script or on script, but oftentimes the campaign or the organization will release the prepared statement.
Right.
And so you have to adjust yourself if they get a question in the middle of it, or if they decide to tell you a personal anecdote and you want to cover that, you're going to have to transcribe that yourself because the organization just has the speech as it was written. So Conyers, the Democrats on his committee officially released his prepared statement. And within half an hour. So we had that up, you know, found the link, linked it, put the post up. The next speech that came in the day on Tuesday was Bernie Sanders endorsing Hillary Clinton. Same exact thing. We got video of the speech, waited for the transcript or the prepared remarks. Turns out, again, they're prepared remarks. They're up at BernieSanders.com, who posts them on the website. Here are the prepared statements of Bernie Sanders endorsing Hillary Clinton. So we have that. We link it. Goes up. Okay. Then we have Barack Obama giving a remarkable speech in Dallas.
Uh-huh.
Not that all of these speeches weren't remarkable, but I didn't think it was as powerful as the speech he gave in South Carolina, the eulogy he gave in South Carolina. But it was a different event and a different level of emotion, I think, was required.
Yeah. But he acquitted himself. I was proud he was my president.
Yeah, I was proud he was my president. I was proud Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton are our candidates. And I was very proud of that moment. And I'm proud of John Conyers, too. Again, that's the easiest one. When Obama speaks, that's just easy peasy for us because WhiteHouse.gov has it up already. Like, OK, you got the video. It's already up. You know, we don't have to wait. It's up. And that's, you know, there's a whole staff of people at the White House whose job it is to make sure at WhiteHouse.gov, everything Obama says that's prepared is linked and up and available. And it's easy to find, very easy to find over there. Okay. Then we get to Donald Trump. And this is when it becomes a story. Because Donald Trump gave a speech in Indiana on Tuesday night. I listened to it. I didn't watch it, but I listened to it while I was working. I had it on and I was listening to it. And I heard the words from my television, and we're going to repeal Obamacare and replace it with something terrific.
Uh-huh.
And I looked up and I looked over at the TV because I wanted to make sure it was Donald Trump saying that.
Right.
Because in the back of my mind, I had thought that that was a Jimmy Fallon line.
Yeah.
That was something Jimmy Fallon said to make fun of Donald Trump.
Because that's a stupid, stupid,
that's
crazy,
a stupid, stupid thing to say.
That no one could possibly take you seriously.
Well, and Donald Trump does say terrific a lot and does say, you know, I think we're going to have a terrific result, or my poll numbers are terrific. I mean, that is one of his favorite adjectives. Yeah. So, you know, yes, he would do that. But replace it with something terrific is something I thought. I've heard Stephanie Miller say, make jokes about that, about we're going to repeal the U.S. Senate and replace it with something terrific. Yeah. You know, I mean, she made that joke. And so I thought, wait, did Donald Trump actually just say that? Yeah, he did. Okay. Yeah.
In
wow.
A speech, in a speech.
That's
all public.
Big news. That's big news. And then he was chanting with his audience about who's going to pay for the wall in Mexico. Well, I've heard that before, right? So, okay. So he's doing both of those things. But it really surprised me that he said, and we're going to repeal Obamacare. We're going to replace it with something terrific.
Because he veered into it. Yeah.
Yeah. And again, I was just, and I know I'm supposed to be more up on what Donald Trump actually says than that. But in this case, I was surprised that he said that. So yesterday I was thinking about this and thinking, wow, you know, here we have a day of speeches, really a real solid day of speeches. And I remembered from working on Tuesday at Crooks and Liars of, we're waiting for the transcript on this. We're waiting for the transcript on this. We've got the WhiteHouse.gov transcript. And so I'm thinking, Donald Trump, is there a transcript? Is there a transcript of what he said? And I looked at his website. There's no link to his speeches. I looked on Google, you know, Donald Trump transcripts. No, can't find. And I'm looking for Indiana, July 12th. Okay, I'm really, I want specifically a transcript or the prepared statement of this particular speech. I mean, I assumed that Replace It With Something Terrific wasn't in the script because I don't think that Paul Manafort would type that into a speech and put it on a teleprompter.
I don't know. I assume at this point it's a macro in the word processor.
You just push Alt-C, right?
Yeah, that's it.
So, but I couldn't find it. I couldn't find the prepared statement. I couldn't find, a transcript. No media outlet had transcribed it. Which surprised me, and I didn't want to transcribe it. Let me put it that way. And I know there are programs, there's Dragon Speech and Dragon things, and you can use to transcribe things. But I just thought it was really weird that Donald Trump's speeches are not posted at his website. And so in the end, I went to Twitter, which is, you know, a really great place to search for things, and looked up Donald Trump transcript. And someone had linked in kind of a fourth generation sort of way to a link to a link to a link of Donald Trump's prepared statements. And they are at assets.donaldjtrump.com/ and then all these digits, you know, numbers and so forth. So it is on Donald Trump's server, official server. There is no link to it. It's a PDF file. There is no link to it on his front page, but it's stored there. And someone had it, had access to it and linked it. And then someone linked to that on Twitter. And I found it. I found the PDF of his prepared statement. In this particular case, it actually had footnotes. So again, Paul Manafort is sort of backing up what Donald Trump is officially going to say with links to New York Times articles, seriously. But I searched that speech for the word Mexico. It's not in there. And the word Obamacare. It's not in there. So he went off script for those two things.
At least those two things.
At least those two things, but specifically those two things. Uh-huh. And so I mentioned it to Carolee, who's my editor, and I said, I want to write a post about this, that, you know, he goes off script in a major way. Unlike, I mean, Hillary Clinton and John Conyers and Bernie Sanders and Barack Obama might go off script. That is their prerogative of anyone who's giving a speech to go off script and add something or say something or make an emotional appeal.
Riff a little bit.
But Donald Trump really goes off script.
Yeah.
And habitually. And I know that drives his campaign staff crazy. But I mentioned it to my editor and I said, you know, I want to write about this because this is a thing that not just that Donald Trump goes off script, but that the media doesn't transcribe what he says anymore. You know, they just don't. And it's not on the website
right,
in a printed form that he said this. The Donald Trump show is just a show. And she said to me, I watched him do that. I watched him switch to Obamacare in Mexico. He was losing the audience and he wanted to get the audience back. And he's very good at emotionally hooking an audience into what he's saying. And this is me talking now. You know, he is good at emotionally hooking an audience. And so when he saw he was losing the audience with the teleprompter and with whatever Paul Manafort told him to say, mm-hmm. he just went right back to safety zone of we're going to repeal Obamacare and build a wall.
White power, white power.
White power, white power. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is a very bad sign for the Trump campaign. It's a very bad sign for the Republican National Convention. But it also says something really important about the media, which is they're really not covering Donald Trump.
No.
And we have to. And so there is now a Twitter feed as of this morning called, I think it's called Literal Trump. Have you heard about this?
Nope.
Literally. I think it's, hold on, I'm going to look for it. I think it's called Literally Trump. And yeah, it's Literally Trump. And it is a Twitter feed of what Trump has said. In other words, they are doing the job of the media of transcribing what he said and using the word literally correctly, by the way. In the fight to stop Donald Trump, we've got a devastating tool. Literally Donald Trump, follow for a daily dose of stuff he's actually said. He told Jeb Bush to speak English while in the United States.
Yeah. Can I jump you to another example?
Yeah.
That's right. This is out of Charlie Pierce's column today.
Okay.
Charlie Pierce, who is on the scene, who is in Cleveland, Ohio, who's taking dictation. And this is Donald Trump speaking on the stump, just like you were talking about, on Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, the other night you had 11 cities potentially in a blow-up stage, marches all over the United States, and tough marches, anger, hatred, exclamation point, started by a maniac, and some people asked for a moment of silence for him, for the killer. Now, here's the thing, as Charlie Pierce points out. Number one, this didn't happen.
Yeah.
There's no evidence at all anywhere from anyone, credible source, half-credible source of any kind, that there were 11 cities that this is going to happen in, or 9 or 3 or whatever. This is 57 communists in the State Department. You're just pulling shit out of thin air. Nobody called for a moment of silence. Nobody. This was a straight-up white supremacist battle cry to his crazy people. And if you do a quick Google search, just a quick one, you will find that the people who were reported on this are Talking Points Memo, Mother Jones, Talking Points Memo, Gawker, Mother Jones, Liberal America, Alan Combs, etc., Shakesville, and places like that. There is a mention of CBS in there somewhere, but there's no massive media holy crap outrage. There's no transcript. Yeah. There's no link to it. There's no place you can go to see the incredibly racist lies that pour out of this man's mouth every day on what should be an official record anywhere in the media.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's on purpose.
Yeah. Yeah. So absolutely right.
I didn't mean to.
No, I'm done. So I just.
But this.
It is shame on the media, though. That is the point. Is it is shame on the media for not recognizing that it is important to note what he says.
Right.
And I also want to applaud Charlie Pierce, since you just did, for his coverage of what happened with the whole notorious RBG.
Yeah.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And by the way, she apologized this morning.
I know. I do not accept your apology, RBG.
We do not accept your apology, no. Ruth Bader Ginsburg. We want you to stick to your guns. But I understand why she did. This is not a, you know, two wrongs make a right situation where, well, Scalia did it. And so, you know, Scalia was all political and played golf with people. And Bush v. Gore was very political. And then Thomas and Scalia both had kids and wives, you know, get jobs in the Bush administration after that. So that's political. No, the point about this is everybody in elected office, in official office, in Washington, D.C., anyone with a position of responsibility, anyone with a microphone should be denouncing Donald Trump the way Ruth Bader Ginsburg did.
Loud.
Sake of America.
And the reason he is the Republican nominee is that the media is constructed in such a way as to prevent that from ever happening.
Mm-hmm.
It is absolutely built so that this is what Hunter Thompson had to say about Richard Nixon. You know, Richard Nixon looked good on paper. You know, objective journalism could never get Richard Nixon. You had to get subjective. You had to understand what sort of man he really was. You had to really go under his skin and figure out the way his brain was working. And Donald Trump is the same way. Donald Trump has just blown past all of the barricades on the way to a nomination because those barricades are set up to create a horse race and keep it running in the same direction. I've used this analogy before. Liberals complain about the Iraq war, being lied into the Iraq war in 72-point font. Republicans complain that Barack Obama wants to murder their grandparents and he wasn't in this country legally and he wasn't even born here and he's a secret Kenyan Muslim in 72-point font. The media just slaps those two up and says, isn't it a shame how both sides are so loud and angry?
Yep.
And as Rick Overton, bless his heart, pointed out on the Stephanie Miller show this morning, because I needed a laugh. He went through a whole bunch of things that Republicans get mad about, transgender bathrooms, things. He said, you'll notice they all have one thing in common. They're all fucking imaginary.
Mm-hmm.
They're shit they just made up because their angry, stupid, bigoted, white, male base desperately wants to hate homos. And they desperately want to hate.
That's what Bill Maher said on. Bill Maher said that same thing last night on Hardball.
And you can't, if you're a member of. Again, this is sort of getting back to our science fiction university, which is coming up next. There is a vast business structure behind and around the news you see. What we will talk about, what we won't, what subjects are under discussion, what subjects are not under discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And very clearly, that we're not going to say Republicans are racist. We're not going to say the Republican Party is fundamentally, existentially ruined.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not going to say the Republican Party and the Democratic Party are different. They each have their dysfunction. One of them is a venial sin. One of them is a mortal sin.
You're really going with Charlie Pierce.
Yes,
again.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
and you know, to that point, not to interrupt you too much, but CNN, when they had Corey Lewandowski on, who by the way is getting paid severance pay still by the Trump campaign.
Oh, that's nice.
They talked about the poll that says that racism and prejudice is taking over the political campaign, the political structure, and 61% of the American people think that. And the CNN host, whose name is Poppy something.
Poppy Harlow.
Yeah. Thank you. Poppy Harlow, her real name, introduced that poll by saying, and both sides feel this way, and on both campaigns, and it's dividing America. And this is the meme. This is the absolute meme of the mainstream media right now, is that Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are dividing America over prejudice and racism, and it's dividing America.
Yes.
And then you look at, and they actually had the poll on the screen. Who is responsible for this? Donald Trump, 67%. Hillary Clinton, 16%.
Yeah.
What do you think, Corey Lewandowski?
And
I think Donald Trump's going to win big among Hispanics.
Right.
What?
Right.
So now we're going to talk about that. We're not going to talk about blaming Donald Trump for prejudice in our politics.
No.
Because that will erase the horse race that we have to have.
Well, and
it has to be both sides.
And we will talk about Donald Trump, but we will not talk about Donald Trump as the personification of the Republican Party base.
Right.
Which is
right.
what he is. And it is.
We won't talk about the fact that racist people like what Donald Trump says and have from the beginning.
And have said so really clearly.
Yep. Yeah,
the thing Donald Trump has done is given them permission to stop, you know, to sort of loosen their belt after Thanksgiving dinner, to let it hang out. Yeah. He says what he's feeling, and I can respect that. So let me tell you what I think about the Negro. And that's, he's turned that loose in the country. Mm-hmm. We've been saying, liberals have been saying for literally decades, this is what the Republican Party really is under the hood. Please, for God's sakes, listen to us. I don't want the Republican Party destroyed. I want the poison drained out of it. And all you're doing is draining all the healthy fluids out and letting the poison grow and fester and become the fucking party. That's
mm-hmm.
been the liberal critique for decades. And no one has listened. Absolutely. In fact, it isn't just no one listened. If that was your position, you were actively exiled from the political conversation
That's
in the
it.
Country.
That's it.
Nobody
yep.
wanted to hear a fucking word you were saying. Only after Bill Kristol and Eric Erickson and Rick Wilson have shit themselves in public,
mm-hmm.
Are people willing to say, oh my God, something weird happened to the Republican Party?
Yep.
And what's been the actual net result of that? More FaceTime for Hugh Hewitt.
Yep.
And a CNN contract for Corey Lewandowski.
Exactly.
Because
exactly.
we can't have the fucking liberals on the show. And I wrote a post years ago called Regression to the Meme, which is no matter how far out, no matter how bad the crisis is, no matter how clearly a conservative atrocity is staring you in the face, the Beltway media will always regress to the meme. And the meme used to be liberals bad, conservatives good. Liberals dumb, conservatives smart. But the Bush administration killed that. And so then the meme became both sides. Isn't
right.
it a shame how both sides were wrong about the Iraq war? Isn't it a shame how both sides don't care about deficits? Isn't and on and on and on. And it's become a joke. It is a running joke everywhere but inside of that 20 square mile area where the media live.
Right, right. And so it is so blatant that I can write a post at Crooks and Liars that says, on CNN, 67 versus 16
right.
is an even split. Because it is.
That's the new math. Well,
that's the new math.
And it's so... I just want to add one more thing.
And then we're going to switch gears to your Steve Gilliard story.
It'll fit right in there, I promise.
Good.
Smooth as silk. The two most egregious examples this week of that phenomenon, and really, it really is all of this horrific tragedy out there, all of this, you know, boiling over in American society. How do we calm it down? How do we find our way through it? And on Meet the Press, Chuck Todd, who's an employee of NBC, who is an employee of Comcast, clearly got the memo that we are not going to start pointing fingers at Republicans and conservatives and Donald Trump in any fucking way that doesn't also include pointing the finger at Hillary Clinton.
Right.
And
right.
Chuck Todd said, but can either of these candidates, among the least popular, least trusted, most divisive in history, somehow become the president that heals a nation desperately in search of unity? Senator Cory Booker, I understand you made a case against Mr. Trump, but how does Hillary Clinton, who's almost as polarizing and divisive, how does she make the case? But she's the candidate here for reconciliation. Now, Chuck Morrill is an...
And Cory Booker, to his credit...
Yeah. As I said...
Rejected the premise of the question.
He's slapping no labels, let's blame everyone, dick right out of Chuck Todd's mouth.
Yes, he did.
He did. And Chuck Todd shit himself. And Cory Booker said, I patently disagree with you. Mm-hmm. And explained to him, no, this is just... What you just said is absolutely not true. And Chuck Todd sat there going... And he literally said, all right, okay, all right. And Cory Booker just put the bill of particulars on the table. No, Donald Trump is deliberately going out of his way to insult people of different races, insult gender differences, build walls. He refuses to denounce openly racist people in his campaign. And the best Chuck Todd could manage was, Senator Cory Booker says, Senator Corker, Senator Booker, I'm going to have to leave it there.
Right.
Because this is a show that was built around, why can't we have an honest conversation about race?
Right.
And Cory Booker started to have an honest conversation about race, and Chuck Todd shut that shit down immediately.
Yep.
Then Michael Gerson came on and pulled the same shit. Isn't it a shame how both sides are terrible and both sides are awful and both sides are tragically misinformed? David Brooks on the New York Times, same thing. Oh, we're going to hell in a handbasket. Isn't it a shame how both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton are so divisive and awful? And it's so clear to anyone who isn't bribed or brain dead or Republican that the corporate media has been purchased by people who have a very specific narrative that they are goddamn well and good going to sell you.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't matter how far out of whack with reality it is. Chuck Todd, get your ass out there and sell this shit to those idiots who watch this show, or you'll go the way of David Gregory.
Right. And Donald Trump is doing all of this because that is what won Republican primaries.
Right.
And that he has not switched gears to the general election and admitted that most of America is actually reasonably centrist. You know, and sure, you have to be a little bit to the right in the primaries, but in the general election, you move to the center because that's where America is.
Right.
And Donald Trump knows that the 33% of people who vote Republican every time agree with him 100% on the racism and the divisiveness, and that Barack Obama is a Kenyan usurper here to destroy America, et cetera, et cetera. They believe all that shit. And so he's going to, when the general election teleprompter speech doesn't work with that crowd, Donald Trump switches gears and says, repeal Obamacare and build a wall.
And however big a monster Donald Trump really is, that is the font size the media will use to describe Hillary Clinton or whoever runs against it or whoever would have run against it. Because it is imperative that they preserve the holy both-siderist narrative.
Yeah.
And that narrative cannot survive pointing at Donald Trump and saying, no, this is the party that's broken and needs to be run out of town or rail.
And so
they'll just keep lying. And they will keep lying and keep lying until it becomes professionally unpleasant and financially disastrous for them to continue lying. And again, as the wheels came off the Iraq war, I mentioned this before, there was a moment when the lie could not be sustained any longer.
Right.
And that's when David Gregory and the rest of the assholes who run the media, or who are the frontmen for the media, were flailing around looking for a way to not say the liberals were right.
Mm-hmm.
And they succeeded.
Yep.
At no point do I remember anyone ever, except John Heilman once, I swear to God, John Heilman once said, you know, liberals were kind of pissed about being treated that way during the Iraq war, and they kind of had a point.
Yeah.
That was the only time I've ever heard anyone anywhere in the mainstream Beltway media ever admit liberals were right about Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They say, well, we can all agree now. But no, let's talk about what happened back then. Speaking of back then, I thought yes. it would be useful. I thought it would be useful to revisit my blog father, the late great Steve Gilliard, who had.
And you are a blogger because of Steve Gilliard.
I am. Steve Gilliard yep. was the first front page blogger. This is, sort of goes back to Netroots Nation. Netroots Nation used to be called Yearly Coast because it was a function of the Daily Coast website, blog, etc., a media empire. And the very first front pager on Daily Coast was Steve Gilliard. And Marcos Melitzis eventually told him, you know, kept putting him up there, and Steve finally struck out on his own and created the news blog. And the news blog was a place for many, many, many of us to gather during the darkest days of the Bush administration. And I started out as a commenter. This is sort of passing along the blogging tradition. I started out there as a commenter. Steve kept dragging my comments up from the comment section and making them into posts. Now I understand why. Not because I was talented, but because it was content.
Yeah.
And eventually you get really tired of waiting up till 2 a.m. for the New York Times editorial page to drop and then write something till 3 a.m. just to stay ahead of the curve. But Steve was good enough to bring my stuff out of storage often enough and then finally just said, dude, get out of here.
Mm-hmm.
Go start your own blog. Get out of here. But the reason and then he passed away shortly thereafter. Yes, I killed Steve Gilliard.
No, you didn't.
Yeah, I couldn't stand the competition, so I... No.
It's not too soon to say that, fortunately. I know Steve Gilliard is not, like me, when I die, Steve Gilliard's not resting in peace.
No.
Steve Gilliard is up there fighting the good fight. Absolutely.
And anyone who remembers Steve remembers Fuck the Fucking Yankees.
Fuck the Fucking Yankees. That's right.
And remembers that he was a practical man who understood how politics worked.
Yep.
And that he was always, and he was a smart politician. He understood how political operations work. And everyone misses him. To this day, it's been many years since he passed away, but people still, if you mention Steve in a conversation among people who were there, they'll say, God, I miss that guy.
Yep.
God, I miss that guy. And you go through his old writing, which is still out there. Nobody visits it anymore. It's in the far, far corner of the lefty blogger cemetery. But it's, I especially missed him during the Obama administration. Because the most famous and best, most muscular black blogger commenting on Barack Obama would have been a wonderful thing to see.
Mm-hmm.
A rare and beautiful thing to see. But there is some contention out there about what might have happened. You know, if only things were different and only things had changed and we have this unique situation now in 2016 and, you know, the factors are just, you know, have never been this way. And I thought it'd be useful just to go back and say, you know what? In 2004, we had a patently unqualified Republican candidate. We had an outsider, a fierce outsider, who had opposed the Iraq War. And we had a center-left insider who had voted for the Iraq War, fighting over the Democratic nomination.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a third-party candidate who was polling, as I wrote, barely to the right of the decimal point, playing that siren song to disaffected liberal unicorn hunters to come over and be more pure. Be over here. You have to be pure. You don't have to vote for those stinky people over there. Come be with me. Sit over here by me. And those were all in play in 2004. It's not exactly the same as 2016, but it's really damn close. It's really, really similar. And I thought, well, you know.
So the personalities are George W. Bush.
Yep.
Was running for re-election.
Was.
Howard Dean is the anti-war, voted against the war candidate.
Who's also mastering the youth vote.
Yep.
Getting people to vote because of the way politics is changing their life. They're getting involved for the first time. They're passionate about it. And he's using new technology.
Yeah.
He's going directly to people through the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had John Kerry, who ran a crappy, clunky campaign and had voted for the Iraq War. And then you had Ralph Nader, who was out there going, you know what? Both parties are equally corrupt. There's not a dime's worth of difference between them. Blah 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 blah. You know, if you want to waste your vote propping up the corrupt duopoly, blue gal, go right ahead. Or you can vote your conscience and be pure and vote for me. So the factors were all there. This is not new. This is the thing I wanted to get across. this is not the first time we've been to this rodeo by a long shot. This happens quite often in politics. It just seems new if you've never been in this space before. So I went back and looked through Steve, who is an, you know, unimpeachably left-wing, fighting, liberal blogger, who is out there every day putting his chin out and fighting like hell to get the best possible candidate in to defeat George Bush and move the country back away from the abyss. And in 2003, he had really nice things to say about Howard Dean. Dean's campaign was doing something very different. He was mobilizing people. He was mobilizing youth. There were mental changes undergone by the people who participated. They felt passionate. Dean is using what has been called, now I'm quoting Steve, leaderless resistance. His campaign comes up with themes that the people out in the field work on their own. It doesn't cost the campaign money. And the transformative leadership comes from Dean with a healthy dose of empowerment. The 527s, the internet, this is a completely new thing happening in politics. While the Kerry campaign was clunking and stumbling and really, he wrote a whole post on how to be a loser. In December 2003, he was like, John Kerry pissed away his chance to be president when he trusted Bush Co. not to lie to him. But then Steve said, I'll cut him some slack for that vote because Cheney and his boys were playing this game like Nixon. Lie to everyone and hope for the best.
So
you fell for it. Yeah, you shouldn't have, but I'll cut you some slack because, you know. But it was, the Kerry campaign was nothing to be proud of in December 2003. It was dumb. It was stuck in the mud. Meanwhile, Howard Dean was out there being fast and agile and smart. Dean is the only one running a smart campaign, says Steve, in December 2003. And these things were really important because, very much like Donald Trump, Steve's overriding imperative was everyone has a real simple point. Bush must be defeated. He's just too incompetent to keep that job for another 4 years.
Right.
Period. Everything else is real important. Getting this lunatic the hell away from the nuclear codes and out of the White House is the imperative. And everything else is important but secondary. But in the end, Dean lost, and the Democrats nominated Kerry. And how did Steve Gilliard react? Did he, as I write, flounce off stage, raging about the horrors of staining his ideological purity? No. He wrote a long post entitled, Why John Kerry Should Be President. And it was really clear. It was, you know, basically an honorable man. He stuck his chin out when it counted. He volunteered to go off to war. He's a good guy. He's ran a crappy campaign, but holy God, is he so much better than the other guy.
So it's Bernie Sanders' speech this week.
Absolutely. And then, and this is not widely remembered, Howard Dean went out to campaign for John Kerry.
Howard Dean
debated Ralph Nader.
Right.
And there was this hope that maybe we could get the Nader people on board because Dean's like, look, I was out there, man. I was campaigning. I said some terrible things about John Kerry. But let me tell you, it's time for us to get together and take out Bush because he is the much, much greater threat.
Yep. He's the problem.
He is the problem. And Ralph Nader, being Ralph Nader, said no.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
We're not going to do that because he quoted Dean during the primary. You know, he quoted Dean as saying that Kerry was a corporate clone, very much like Donald Trump is now quoting Bernie Sanders to attack Hillary Clinton. He cut Dean down, talked about how he had sold out to the establishment and how he was now a hack for hire, et cetera, et cetera. And it didn't work.
Yep.
And then, but Steve bracketed this coverage in a post entitled "Every Vote for Nader Condemns an American Soldier to Death."
He didn't sugarcoat it, Steve.
He was unequivocal. Look, got it. But if you're voting for this guy, you're taking away from that guy.
Yep.
And talk is cheap. And he says Ralph Nader's selfishness and short-sightedness works against his professed goals and towards not only the continuation of the war, but the expansion of it. Ralph, he's saying, if you gave a shit about what you talked about, you would not empower Bush by trying to drag down the only person who has a legitimate shot of taking him down.
Yep.
And that, I just wanted to get on the record as
this is not new.
This is not new.
this is not new.
And it isn't to, oh, and by the way, just for extra bonus points in the post, I put in links to various conspiracy theories about, that were being kicked around on the internet about how John Kerry and Howard Dean and various other New World Order agents were conspiring to take down the only real honest candidate, who is, of course, Lyndon LaRouche. Wake up, sheeple! Wake up, sheeple! And then once it had been settled, Time magazine cover was, the winner of the American election will inherit a nation divided, one split over its place in the world, its basic values, and its future direction. And after such a venomous campaign, will it be possible to pick up the pieces, bridge the gaps, and reunite the United States? For the whole world, the stakes could not be high. Does that sound familiar at all to anyone? That
sounds exactly like Chuck Todd.
Yes.
And the stakes are so high. And both sides are both divisive.
Both sides are so
high. What are we going to do?
Divisive.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. This is not to take away from anyone who was or is a Bernie supporter or who wants to walk away. This is to say, Steve Gilliard understood politics and had been through this a few times before.
Yep.
If you have been through any political campaign any number of times, this is how it works. These are the players on the board almost all the time in almost all the races I remember. I parked my vote with John Anderson in 1980 because I didn't want to vote for Reagan because he was crazy. I didn't want to vote for Jimmy Carter because he wasn't pure enough for me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Reagan is on me.
Yep.
But I learned that that's not how politics works.
Yep.
That's how
and your vote does count in the primary. And then it counts again in the general election. And that's the point.
Your
vote counts. So please make it the right one for the candidate. It's not lesser of two evils, particularly in this case.
Well, and
it's dumpster fire versus a future.
And one of the reasons I decided to write this up is I was taking incoming fire from old fans who were just saying, you know, I used to admire you, man, before you became a Hillary bot, you know, before you just threw in your, you know, if you had just have given Bernie a chance, man.
Well, but Driftglass, I got a four screen email. Maybe you got it too. Saying that we weren't supporting Hillary enough.
Right. And that's the point. I
totally sympathize with everyone on MSNBC who gets mail both ways.
Yeah.
You know, of your and I know that Rachel Maddow's emails and mail is 50-50. You're in the tank for Bernie. You're in the tank for Hillary. You're doing the wrong thing.
Absolutely.
And so,
this is to say, if you go back and listen to our podcast, remember it's $9.95 for each new listen. So, it's still free, and they're all still out there. We've been really clear all along, I think, that we like Bernie Sanders. We admire Bernie Sanders.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to support Bernie Sanders. We're going to send Bernie Sanders money. But we're not going to denigrate Hillary Clinton, and we're not going to tear her down, and we're going to vote at the end of the day. We're going to give our support and our time and our money and our little we have, and certainly our vote, to the person that Bernie Sanders supports at the end of his campaign.
Yep.
And that turned out to be Hillary Rodham Clinton. So if that comes as a shock to you, or if you think that we have been in the tank for Hillary all this time, believe me, shock on Twitter has been hysterical about, why can't you see that Bernie's a monster?
Like, he's been really hard on us.
He's like, here, read this pamphlet. And like, you know, I get it, dude. I get it. And I'm not, you're not hearing me say that Hillary is a beast who should never be elected. And I will, you're hearing me say, I have multiple choices at this point in time. One of them, in my opinion, is better than the other. That doesn't make the other one the devil. So.
Right.
And as long as we play clean, and for the most part, it was a pretty clean campaign. It certainly wasn't as dirty as ones I've seen. Absolutely not. But at the end of the day, the person who lost got some of what they wanted and put in there and fell in line behind the party and supported the candidate that they most agree with. And so will I.
Yeah.
And if you don't understand that, then you really don't understand how politics works. And that's fine, because you'll learn. But
this is sort of
always the way it is. And it's a matter of incremental changes, moving forward, electing people who are horribly imperfect and hoping for the best.
Right.
And that's all we can hope for.
Thank you very much, Drift Glass.
My pleasure, Blue Gal.
Each week we post to our Facebook page and website an internet kitty sent in by you, the listeners. This week's internet kitty is Arlo. Arlo, of course, is named after the legendary folk singer and champion of the working man, Arlo Guthrie. But to be honest, Drift Glass, this Arlo neither knows nor cares to know what it's like to work for a living.
No.
It's not his job.
No. No life on the rails for this one.
No, not for this internet kitty. You can send your internet kitty to us at our email address, proleftpodcast@gmail.com, where you can also write to both of us. Feel free to write us. We love hearing from you. Be aware that if you write us at any of our addresses, we reserve the right to read your email or U.S. Postal Service Go Postal Unions letter on the air unless you say otherwise. Don't forget our gourmet coffee guideline. If you can afford to buy an espresso-based beverage for yourself, buy one for us. And don't forget our Amazon link at our website. We believe in buying local. And we also believe in shopping Amazon with our link if your alternative is a big box store. Approximately 1% of our listeners support this podcast with a cash contribution. You can, too. See our website, professionalleft.blogspot.com, for details. Both our PayPal and postal address information is there at professionalleft.blogspot.com. Please rate our show on iTunes or Stitcher Radio, and thank you for doing that. And don't forget to listen to us this weekend, Saturday afternoon. I'm not sure what time, but we will be at netrootsradio.com, and we will tweet that out when we're going to be there.
In public and everything.
In public and everything. Hey, Drift Glass, how are the internet kitties doing this week?
Well, Blue Gal, the internet kitties say...
So long, Screwy. See you in St. Louis.
Let's think about living.
Think about living.
Let's think about loving.
Think about loving.
Let's think about the hooping and the hopping and the popping and the loving, lovey-dovey. Let's forget about the whining and the crying, the shooting and the dying, and the fellow with the switchblade knife. Let's think about living. Let's think about life.
Professional Left Podcast is recorded under a Creative Commons license, copyright 2016, Drift Glass, Blue Gal Podcast.
Minecraft is awesome! Now it's time for Science Fiction University with our science fiction expert, Drift Glass.
Science Fiction University, Drift Glass, this week we are not reading stories because we're busy. We're heading out to Netroots Nation tomorrow morning. We're recording this on Thursday. And so, but what we wanted to do today in Science Fiction University is two things. One is we want to talk about Mr. Robot.
Yeah.
And number two is we want to introduce a new prompt for you guys. Now, we have a couple of stories in the wedding summer vacation left to read, but we wanted to get you guys started on a new prompt. For those of you that want to write us four paragraphs, you will send them in an email to proleftpodcast@gmail.com. The prompt in honor of Mr. Robot is tell us your robot story. And we just came up with this because we were watching Mr. Robot and we thought, hey, that's a good prompt.
And make it and sexy.
You don't have to make it sexy, but robot, artificial intelligence, creature. It doesn't have to be humanoid. It doesn't have to be anything. It can be any kind of robot that you want to imagine. Uh-huh. And four paragraphs. Please put robot story in your subject line and send it again as an email to proleftpodcast@gmail.com. Don't put it as an attachment. Don't share it with us on Google Docs. Don't try to set me fancy.
Nope.
Just paste those, proofread them, read them out loud, make sure they're spelled correctly, make sure they're punctuated correctly as if you are submitting them for publication, because in a way you are, and then paste that edited text into an email and send it to proleftpodcast@gmail.com, subject line robot story, and we will read your story and critique it on the air.
One more suggestion.
Yes.
12-point double space, please.
We just print out these emails and read them. And, yes. And if I have to paste them into a word processor and increase the font and space out the paragraphs and so forth, if I'm doing that much editing to them, that makes it very hard for us to get to them.
Your grade will suffer. Let's just put
your
it
that grade
way.
Let grade reflect. So we appreciate you guys doing the work to write this and provide free content for our show. I don't want anyone to think we're not appreciative of that. And we love reading your stories. You guys are so talented. So, but this is what we hope we are giving you is an impetus to write. That's what we hope we are giving you in exchange. And so send us your robot stories. We would love to have them. And Mr. Robot, Driftglass, I want to first of all talk about whether the show Mr. Robot is science fiction or not. I think it is because Andy Greenwald has a show about it. But there must be some other criteria for what a science fiction story is.
Well, Chris Hardwick has a show about it.
That's true. Yeah. So is Mr. Robot science fiction?
Well, yes, it is. It's an alternate history story.
Yeah. It takes place in the near future, too.
In the immediate future.
Although they gave it a year last year of 2015, so I guess it's alternate history, like you say. Yeah.
It is clearly the science in it, as we learned from watching the nerds talk last night, is they're extremely rigorous about their hacking language.
Mm-hmm.
If something is going to work on the show, someone has to be able to make it work in the real world.
Right, right.
So their fidelity to the skill sets and behaviors of hackers is really good.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a work of fiction. And a group of hackers has not collapsed the global economy. Therefore, it is science fiction. Because if you take the science out, if you remove the hacking, if you remove the alternate history of the United States, there's no story.
Story falls apart.
And
right.
It's also perfectly legitimate to have a story that goes on inside someone's head.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing wrong with that. That isn't strictly speaking science fiction, but a lot of good science fiction has taken place inside of the imagination of a protagonist.
Right.
So it's awesome too, and it has robot in the title. So God damn it, we're just going to let it in. And it's a really,
amen to that.
It is a magnificent show.
It really is. And I think I personally think, having slept on it, that it's gotten better. I think season two, at least the first two episodes that we watched last night, I feel are it's become a more interesting and well-developed character study than it was. The hacking and the crime element of it, F Society part of it was a very big part of it last year. Uh-huh. And I think this time we're really getting to see the conflicts within Elliot that, you know, and I don't want to do spoilers at this point because some people haven't seen it yet.
Right.
And we'll watch it over the weekend or whenever.
So I do want to
let people catch up. But yeah, I think it's an amazing character study to figure out what Elliot is all about and how he manages his mental state.
Elliot is a classic, and I mean this in the Edgar Allan Poe, telltale heart sense, unreliable narrator.
Yes.
And the show, and I won't, again, no spoilers, because that is totally unfair, because it's such a wonderful show to watch and let it unfold naturally.
Mm-hmm.
The first season, it is fair to say that the show was Elliot talking to the Elliot talking to the camera.
Mm-hmm.
This was a direct address to you. There's a person he's talking to,
mm-hmm.
and that person is usually you, the camera,
mm-hmm.
the person.
Mm-hmm.
His relationship with the person to whom he is narrating has changed.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes the story really interesting.
And when he announced that.
Yes, it was,
your eyebrows just went up. And you just curled up into into a ball when that happened as a writer. I mean, you're like, his relationship with his audience is different this year, and that's amazing. Yeah.
In a way that really makes it possible for them to tell a totally different story.
Mm-hmm.
Or really advance the story in a very different way.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's very smart, and I'm not going to say any more than that. There are little moments in there that are purely business,
mm-hmm.
just stuff that they get so fundamentally right, so perfectly right.
Mm-hmm.
There's a massive hacking attack on a structure, let's say, that is conducted like an orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
It is a perfectly orchestrated attack to accomplish one specific goal, and it's done brilliantly. But there's a moment there where one of our main characters now has a job working for the public relations department. I don't think that's giving anything away. For the massive corporation that was the headquarters of all evil on Earth in season one.
And we knew that was going to happen.
Yeah, yep.
We knew at the end of last season that this that she was going to become part of E-Corp.
Yes.
Right. So
there is a negotiation that happens that's going on by phone between her and the networks.
Mm-hmm.
Leveraging, and she wants, and this, it's put in such a sort of standard operating procedure language that here are the questions you will not ask us.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all negotiating around, okay, but you'll have to give us that. No, because if you don't give us that, we're going to go to this other network. And it's playing corporate media off each other to constrict the story down to what the bad guys are comfortable talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
Man, I can absolutely see that happening every week on Meet the Press.
Yep.
There's an ocean of stories out there to be talked about. And you look at the machinery, and this is really probably the first time I've ever seen, other than in a show like Broadcast News, or a movie like Broadcast News, that even tries to let you look at the business of news
mm-hmm.
for a second and see how this really is a corporate negotiation. You will give us this thing of value, which is the story, in exchange for which mm-hmm. we will not ask you what would contribute to a loss on your bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
And it's handled, it takes 4 minutes, but it's handled in a way that I think is sort of indicative of the quality of the writing of the whole show. And it really goes after, I think, the right villain. Villains are really important in any story like this. You got to have really good villains
mm-hmm.
who are believable, mm-hmm. who don't think of themselves as villains. And I think we're seeing one being created before our very eyes.
One or more villains being created. There's a lot of evil going on in this show.
Uh-huh. We have new characters, by the way. There are new characters.
Yeah. I wanted to point out a couple of things in relation to the news of the month or the news of this summer and Mr. Robot.
Uh-huh.
You might remember that the season finale for Mr. Robot last season was delayed because of the newscaster who got shot on live TV in Virginia. And so because that had happened that morning, USA Network, out of respect for the victims who were Allison Parker and Adam Ward, they were shot on the air during a morning news program, and Mr. Robot delayed and postponed their scheduled season finale because of that.
Right.
And it turns out USA Network had to do that again this summer with a show called Shooter.
Really?
Shooter was set to debut, and it is about an ex-Marine sniper who decides to go and assassinate someone.
Uh-huh.
And so they pushed that back due to Dallas. Now, one of the things that I, without giving anything away, I will tell you is, and not, like I said, no spoilers except to say there are guns in this episode.
Uh-huh.
Opening. There are people who get shot in this episode.
There are.
In various states. And to me, watching that and thinking about it afterwards, I was like, I'm really tired of the shootings.
Yeah.
And so that is something to keep in mind if you're new to the show or if you're sensitive to that sort of thing. This is a dark show.
Yeah.
And things happen that are, oh, my God. There's a lot of, oh, my God.
Yeah. But you know what?
And
none of it is gratuitous.
No, none of it is gratuitous. It all does move the plot along.
Yeah.
It absolutely does. That is true.
And it all makes perfect sense
mm-hmm.
in the moment. Like, of course, this is what happens.
Yep.
But I
think one of the shootings in particular really solidifies what is happening with two of the characters.
Yeah.
Just like, oh, wow. Now we really get it. We really get who is in control of the situation and why and what. Yeah, but there are guns and there are shootings. And so I just want to kind of warn people about that. People have started watching this show because we recommend it, and I do recommend it. I think it's one of the best shows ever on TV that I've ever seen.
And
then
go ahead. the camera work, the lighting, the way that street scenes are shot, just the directorial choice, the scenarist's choices every step along the way tells you, just makes the plot work. You are in a big city and you feel like you're in a big city, and you're in parts of the city you have never visited, or you're seeing them at a different time of day, or you're seeing them from a different angle. And there's one joke that doesn't work. That is, if I were combing through this, looking for things to fault them for, you know, with my editor hat clamped on my head going, okay, I don't get paid today unless I find a flaw in this goddamn story. it would be that the joke was not as effective as the rest of the writing.
Yeah.
It needed to be a hook shot at the end, or it needed something to make it as spicy and vinegary and interesting as the rest of it. But that, again, that's 30 seconds. That's how persnickety, and that's how closely I watched this thing. And that's how picky I was about because it really is flawless. In a lot of in real sense, in the sense of writing, the writing task in front of you, it's just amazing. And so the little, you know, little acne on the shoulder stands out.
One last thing I want to talk about in relation to Mr. Robot is autism.
Yes.
Autism in terms of the character Elliot. Autism in terms of the creator, Sam Esmail, who was interviewed last night on the show. And, you know, he is directing all 12 episodes this season.
Yes. And makes a cameo appearance in at least one.
Yep. In at least one shot. I think in the opening season last year, the opening show last year, was he was on the subway. I think that was the one.
Yep.
There is a book by David Mamet called Bambi versus Godzilla, where David Mamet makes the case that movie directors are all autistic, that Asperger's syndrome, which is a high-functioning form of autism.
Yay!
Things like early precocity, high information processing capacity, unconventionality, seeing things in pictures, communicating in pictures, social deficits, a lack of kindness and politeness, and attachment to routine, and being able to storyboard entire hours because you see them all in front of you.
Right.
You know, that is actually a wiring thing. And so it doesn't surprise, it didn't surprise me when Sam Esmail was on the after show after Mr. Robot. And they were talking about his routine, and he gets up and he edits before he goes onto the set.
Yes.
And he's on the set for 12 hours. And there is so much attention to detail. He has information processing capacity to know dates and times and symbols and visions and things that you know, they talked about Easter eggs and how there's this and this and this and this. And was that all of that intentional? Well, of course it was.
Course
you know,
it was.
This date matches this date matches this date. The time on this clock, three episodes later is the same time on this clock, and on and on and on. And you're like, oh, this guy has the entire 12 episodes of this season. First of all, they're all in the can now anyway.
Right.
But all 12 episodes he has plotted out in his head visually.
Right.
And he does have all of these connections and coincidences and symbols going on in the show to make, and it makes it very interesting. And then you watch his character, his baby, the pride of his life is Elliot.
Elliot, that's right.
And how does Elliot manage and deal and cope with being, how does he put himself in control of his environment?
Right.
And in these opening shots, it is, I think I can safely say, he falls into a routine.
Oh, he doesn't fall into it.
He rigorously
establishes a merciless routine.
Yep.
Not painful, but very rigorous.
Yep.
Specifically to keep himself under control.
Yep, yep. And I will do the same thing every day the same way.
Yep.
And
And any element that is introduced into that routine that requires me to break routine is bad. And I will run from it.
Yes, right. And that is very common.
It is.
In the autistic world of you know, if you tell someone, and we know people, we have people in our family who switch gears.
There are people on this podcast.
There are a couple of people on this podcast who have a hard time if something just gets tossed into the mix. But I'm grateful that our kid, our now high school senior, is able to say that just threw a 360 on me. Right. Yeah, 180 on me. And he'll say that, like, that just put a 180 on me. I can't deal with that. You know, I was expecting something else. And if you can communicate that this stresses you out, that's 90% of the battle, right?
And you're okay to sort of check out and recalibrate yourself and come back.
Yep, yep.
You're not being rude.
But to be able, you know, to have, and it's important for therapists and teachers and parents who have a child like that to say, to warn them. In fact, I got an email today. I'm on all kinds of autism email lists, and it was talking about the new big thing because of Hillary Clinton in training is here. She has a program for training young adults and adults who have autism and getting them into jobs. And the point is not, oh, there are these quote unquote handicapped people who need jobs and we have to somehow mercifully provide them with employment. It's no.
Right. Yeah.
These guys have amazing talent, and if we're not tapping that, we are uncompetitive in the world,
right,
because
we're wasting it. Yeah.
You know, 4/5 of Silicon Valley has this, and if you don't know that and you're not tapping it, believe me, the Danes, the Finns, all of Scandinavia knows to tap that talent. So, the point that this one email made today was part of job training is videotape the workspace, videotape the office, how you get there, even how you get there, what the job entails, and let the person within a safe environment see that. And then they have a predictability of, I have seen this, I know where I'm going, I know what I'm doing. And it allows them to sit within a safe environment, observe where they're going, and have a predictability about it. And depending on how involved the autism is, that can be very helpful.
Yeah.
So,
You can spot us at parties.
Oh, yeah. We're leaving.
We're usually leaving.
Leaving.
I've walked once clockwise, once counterclockwise, and I've done my business, which really surprised. This is now I'm speaking personally. So, because I am ASPE.
Mm-hmm. And I would say so.
Yeah, I'd say so. Everybody I know would say so. But the thing is, not everybody, because I have learned how to talk to people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I'm the one who gets shoved out on stage. I'm the one who gets handed a microphone. I'm the one who gets, you know, we need this room networked. Could you go do that?
But I would rather talk to a room of 500 people than mingle in a room of 15 people.
Oh, absolutely. Because
I'm happy to give a speech because I have control of that situation.
Right. And we're the people who, when we come to a party, will create a job for ourselves.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm the person who will photograph. I'm the person who will collect, you know, just invent some sort of task that is structured that gives this, because there are the people at the other end of the spectrum in this regard enjoy the sort of light and sound and chaos and dancing of social situations.
Mm-hmm.
They draw energy from it. And I've worked with people like that who absolutely did not understand why I was not up dancing, who would drag me onto the dance floor because that's fun. And I was like, no, believe me, this is fucking agony. I hate every minute of this because it's and conveying to people who don't understand how painful that is. It's not something you get over. It's something you learn how to cope with. And so it is a thrill for me to see Junior Dude really learning how to not put his gifts aside, but how to find a way to encounter the world in a way that it welcomes him.
Mm-hmm.
He's learning all the secrets to being a human being on Earth. You know, reading body language, reading facial expressions, shaking hands, all the things that, you know, people like us have to learn because it's not instinctive. It's not intuitive. It's not pleasant until we've, you know, made it so. And that this show is just shot through with that, both in the character level and in the composition of the art itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pleasure to watch. It's just, you know, when you're 10 or 15 minutes into something, when you're 10 or 15 minutes into a shitty movie and you realize, oh, this isn't going to get any better. Let's just call it The Lobster, for example. just to, you know, mention something. And you know it's not going to get any better. You get that sinking feeling like, oh, crap. This is just bad. We should leave. Get 10 or 15 minutes into something good and realize, oh, I'm in the hands of someone who knows what the hell they're doing. There's a calm, a pleasant relaxation that comes over you and realize, oh, I'm in the hands of a genuine artist who knows exactly what they're doing.
Yeah.
And I can just kick back and enjoy the ride because they know what they're doing. That's what I got from watching this. And it's a lot to heap onto a TV show, but really it's a work of art and should be appreciated as such.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Drift Class.
My pleasure, Blue Gal.
We'll be watching again next week, and I don't know how often we'll be updating you on Mr. Robot. We don't want to bore people that don't watch it. But
No, we're going to update him every day, every Thursday, exactly 12 o'clock. It'll take
you'll
exactly
be, you'll
11
be,
and a half
you
minutes.
Can, you can live blog it and live tweet it, Drift Class.
Yeah, no, I need the
Nobody
structure.
Cares.
I need the structure, honey. I need the structure. All right.
I love you.
Love you, too. I hope to see some of you guys on Netroots.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that next.
Okay.
Okay, love you. Bye.
Bye.